Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your Profound Medical fourth quarter full year 2018 financial results conference call. All lines have been placed in a listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. If you should require assistance throughout the conference, please press star zero. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Steve Kilmer, with Investor Relations. Sir, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Let me start by pointing out that this conference call will include forward-looking statements regarding Profound and its business, which may include, but is not limited to, expectations regarding the efficacy of Profound's technology in the treatment of prostate cancer, BPH, uterine fibroids, and palliative pain. Often, but not always, forward-looking statements can be identified by the use of words such as plans, is expected, expects, scheduled, intends, contemplates, anticipates, believes, proposes, or variations, including negative variations, of such words and phrases, or state that certain actions, events, or results may, could, would, might, or will be taken, occur, or be achieved. Such statements are based on the current expectations of management. The forward-looking events and circumstances discussed in this conference call may or may not occur by certain specified dates or at all, and could differ materially as a result of known and unknown risk factors and uncertainties affecting the company, including risks regarding the healthcare industry, economic factors, the equity markets generally, and risks associated with growth and competition. Although Profound has attempted to identify important factors that could cause actual actions, events, or results to differ materially from those described in forward-looking statements, there may be other factors that cause actions, or events, or results to differ from those anticipated, estimated, or intended. No forward-looking statements can be guaranteed. Except as required by applicable securities laws, forward-looking statements speak only as of the date on which they are made, and Profound undertakes no obligation to publicly update or revise any forward-looking statement, whether as a result of new information, future events, or otherwise, other than as required by law. On the call today representing the company are Dr. Arun Menawat, Profound's Chief Executive Officer, and Aaron Davidson, the company's Chief Financial Officer and Senior Vice President of Corporate Development. With that said, I'll now turn the call over to Aaron.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our fourth quarter and year-end 2018 conference call. On behalf of the management team and everyone at Profound, I would like to thank you for your ongoing interest in our company. And for those of you who are shareholders, we appreciate your continued support. I will turn the call over to Arun in a moment for an update on our commercial activities. However, before I do, I'd like to provide a brief update on our fourth quarter and year-end 2018 financial results. To streamline things, all of the numbers I will cite have been rounded and are therefore approximate. For the three-month period ended December 31st, 2018, the company recorded revenue of $1.7 million, with $1.6 million from the sale of products and $81,000 from the installation and training services. Fourth quarter 2018 revenue declined approximately 10% from $1.9 million in the fourth quarter of 2017. Expenditures for R&D increased $299,000 for the 3 months ended December 31st, 2018, compared to the same period in 2017 due to new product initiatives. New R&D projects increased R&D personnel and occupancy costs resulted in a $701,000 increase in expenses, which was partially offset by a decrease in clinical trial costs of $402,000 because of the completion of the TAC pivotal clinical trial enrollment initiatives. General and administrative expenses for the fourth quarter of 2018 were lower by $105,000 compared to the 3 months ended December 31st, 2017. Overall, the company recorded a fourth quarter 2018 net loss of $4.9 million or 4 cents per common share compared with a net loss of $4.5 million or 6 cents per common share for the same period in 2017. Moving to the results for the full year ended December 31st, 2018, the company recorded revenue of $2.6 million, with $2.4 million from the sale of products and $181,000 from installation and training services. The full year 2018 revenue compares to $4.9 million in 2017. Expenditures for R&D increased $627,000 for the year ended December 31st, 2018 compared to 2017. The increase in overall R&D spending was attributed to the Sonalee transaction, which took place in the third quarter of 2017. A higher number of R&D personnel, new Sonalee product initiatives, and a new facility in Finland resulted in a $1.6 million increase in expenses. Offsetting these amounts was a $1.6 million decrease in clinical trial and travel costs and a $67,000 decrease in share-based compensation resulting from the completion of the TAC pivotal clinical trial enrollment initiatives and the forfeiture of certain share options, respectively. Amortization of intangible assets increased by $627,000 due to the Sonalee transaction, which represents 12 months amortization in 2018 versus 5 months amortization in 2017. General and administrative expenses for the full year 2018 were higher by $722,000 compared to the year ended December 31st, 2017. Overall, the company recorded a full year 2018 net loss of $20.8 million or 21 cents per common share, compared with a net loss of $18.8 million or 31 cents per common share in 2017. As of December 31st, 2018, Profound had cash of $30.7 million. I'd now like to briefly review a few corporate financial highlights from 2018. In March, we closed a bought deal financing for aggregate proceeds of $34.5 million. A portion of the $32 million in net proceeds have since been used to support the TAC pivotal clinical trial, global sales and marketing plans for Tulsa Pro and Sonalee, ongoing research and development initiatives, and for general corporate purposes, including the scheduled repayment of the Knight loan. In July, we entered into a term loan agreement with CIBC Innovation Banking to provide a secured loan for total initial gross proceeds of $12.5 million. The loan matures on July 29, 2022, and carries an interest rate based on prime plus 2.5%. This agreement allowed us to consolidate our debt with one banking partner while lowering the overall cost of capital compared to previous term debt obligations. As of December 31st, 2018, the principal balance outstanding on the CIBC loan remained at $12.5 million, and we had an additional $6.25 million available through December 2019, subject to the satisfaction of certain conditions. Finally, we announced our graduation to the TSX on July 11, 2018, and began trading on Canada's premier stock exchange 2 days later. With that, I'll now turn the call over to Arun Menawat.
Thank you, Aaron. First, I'd like to provide some color on our fourth quarter 2018 revenue. On January 3rd, we announced a preliminary unaudited revenue estimate of $1.6 million, which was just below our actual fourth quarter 2018 revenue of $1.7 million. This represents a more than four-fold sequential increase compared with revenue realized in any of the first three quarters of 2018. This was a result of the commercial launch of Sonalee in China and growing interest from European doctors, clinics, and patients in Tulsa Pro. We are maintaining a consistent effort to market Sonalee in Asia and Tulsa Pro in Europe, and the traction we have gained suggests a positive outlook for 2019. I'd like to take this time to review the progress we made in 2018, and I will begin with our Sona Leave system. We reached a major milestone in May with the Chinese Food and Drug Administration's approval of Sona Leave for the non-invasive treatment of uterine fibroids. On our last call, we reported the first Sona Leave system had been sold in China. We continue to rely on our strategic partner, Philips, for lead generation and sale of capital units, primarily in Asia. Turning to progress made on TULSA Pro, at the beginning of the year, we completed enrollment for our TACT pivotal clinical trial to evaluate the safety and efficacy of TULSA Pro to ablate prostate tissue in patients with localized organ-confined prostate cancer. In May, we announced initial data from this trial, whose primary efficacy endpoint is the proportion of patients achieving post-treatment prostate-specific antigen, or PSA, reduction of greater than or equal to 75% of their pre-treatment baseline value. We reported that the median PSA reduction was 95%, with 95% of patients meeting the primary endpoint resolutely. We continue to plan on presenting the full results, including additional secondary endpoints of TACT at AUA in May. In fact, I'm pleased to report that our late-breaking abstract submission has been selected to be presented as part of the AUA's 2019 annual meeting plenary program. We also remain on track to file our 510K application to the FDA for TULSA Pro in the second quarter of this year. In the last quarterly conference call, I talked about what we had learned from the limited launch of TULSA in Europe and how it is helping us prepare for the full launch in the United States. Today, I would like to continue on that theme and further discuss where our doctors are finding clinical value and what we consider to be the key adoption drivers of TULSA. I have personally learned many times in my career that when you have an entirely new paradigm-shifting medical technology, users will lead you to where your company's technology should go if you listen to them. In this case, we are learning that our technology has been used in palliative prostate cancer patients, where it is used to reduce hemorrhaging, radio recurrent salvage patients as a safer treatment option, organ-confined intermediate-stage disease, whole gland or index lesion partial targeted ablation, as well as non-cancerous prostate tissue ablation of the transition zone to alleviate the symptoms of BPH. We find that the highest volume use is in treating organ-confined lesions with targeted partial or focal ablation to increase the possibility of saving normal functions and partial ablation for patients with BPH, particularly with large prostates. Bottom line, we're learning that TULSA is a flexible tool and its best use is customized therapy. Over the last quarter, we were also able to confirm that performing four procedures in a routine day is achieved confidently, making TULSA a fast and repeatable procedure. Finally, we're now also getting feedback from patients that they are tolerating the procedure quite well without significant procedure-related concerns and minimal post-procedure pain. these three pillars, customizability of the treatment to fit the individual patient's needs, predictability that leads to be able to routinely perform multiple procedures in a day, and incision-free ablation leading to high degree of tolerability by the patient are likely to be the three pillars of Profound's marketing strategy. In closing, I'm pleased to invite you to our upcoming inaugural Analyst and Investor Day taking place in New York on April 11th. The meeting will allow you to hear directly from physician users, as the meeting will feature presentations from current commercial TULSA-PRO users in Europe and key opinion leaders in the United States who, as investigators for the CHAC trial, have gained firsthand experience of TULSA-PRO. The event will also include presentations from leading global researchers and clinicians regarding current and potential future applications for Sonalleve. So, in a way, it could be characterized more as a KOL event than the typical analyst day, focusing on the commercial potential of our products. This will be the first of its kind event for Profound that is especially relevant as we move towards commercialization of our technologies in the United States. In summary, we are looking forward to reporting full 12-month results from TACT and submitting a 510K submission to the FDA for TULSA-PRO in the second quarter. We are encouraged with the traction TULSA-PRO has gained in Europe, and combined with the initial commercial launch of Sonalleve in China, expect our sales momentum to continue in 2019. And we are excited to host our first Analyst and Investor Day in April, focusing on commercial opportunities for our technology platform. We hope you will join us. This ends our prepared remarks for today. With that, we're happy to take any questions you might have. Operator.
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset to provide the best sound quality. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. We'll pause just a moment to give everyone a chance to signal. And our first question comes from Jason Mills with Canaccord Genuity. Please go ahead.
Thank you, ma'am. Good morning, Arun. Can you hear me okay? Good afternoon, I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Jason. Right. Yes, very well.
Great, and congrats on a good end of the year. So I had several questions. I'll try to limit them so others can jump in. But first, I'm not sure how much you're willing or able to talk about the upcoming presentation at AUA, but congratulations on getting into their plenary session. I presume you're very excited about that and think that's a great opportunity for the company. Maybe talk about the treatment landscape for prostate cancer, and what do you think the physicians will be looking for? What do you think they would be they would show the most positive response to? What do they want to see, do you think? Subsequent to the data and the ultimate approval from the FDA, maybe talk about your current thoughts on how you plan to develop your commercial infrastructure, your sales force, your marketing plan. You mentioned several applications for TULSA, and the physicians are pulling you in a number of different directions. Clearly, BPH would require, I'm guessing, more clinical work, but perhaps you could talk about how you plan to initially present it to the U.S. market subsequent to these data. So question on the data and what you think doctors are really going to respond to or what they would respond to, and then the question about the commercial plans thereafter.
Thank you, Jason. These are great questions. So I'll try to be very quick in summarizing, and we'll most definitely provide a lot of detail on April 11th on these type of questions. But first of all, yes, you're right. We are certainly excited about the fact that the abstract has been accepted in the plenary session, so it will be presented at the meeting. With respect to the feedback, I think that we have been visiting, you know, a number of urologists, and we have been discussing the various uses, and we've been kind of asking the question in terms of which type of patients, you know, would resonate first, where do they want to get started. And I think the two areas that are much, much more very, very comfortable for them, for example, radio recurrent cancer patients and palliative care patients. For example, one of the things we hadn't even realized that these patients who are palliative, their prostates continue to grow and they end up with bleeding and they end up with catheters, and the catheters clog because of the hemorrhaging and bleeding, and they end up with hospitals. And with our technology, they can simply ablate them because they don't need to do a major procedure, which they won't do on palliative cases. But in 2 hours, they can do an ablation, and then that ablation basically cauterizes the blood vessels. So it's a very comfortable, very quick way for them to experience with our device. It's a very, very helpful procedure for the patient, and it's a cost saving for the payers because these patients don't have to be hospitalized all the time. The same thing on radio recurrent, where, again, very quickly, because of our computer automated, you know, closed-loop process control, they can mark the margins of unusual boundaries of the prostates, and they can very quickly ablate those prostates, and hopefully they can catch them early enough before they become metastatic, in which case the patients will, you know, have good urinary function, good bowel function, and be able to have become cancer-free. So those are certainly some of the places that are going to be very quick for us to get involved with. I think over the longer haul, I think there's a large group of population where there's an overlap between patients who have large prostates and have BPH and have some form of cancer. And we think that group will get basically a two-for-one. They can get their BPH symptoms relieved, and they can get their cancer treated. And so I think that targeted treatment that is targeted towards cancer and very well designed, and we'll go over the design of these of the BPH, ablation for BPH, that those patients would be ideal for startup. So I hope that gives you a little bit of color on how we're thinking. With respect to our...
Arun, if you don't mind, Aaron Davidson here. Just to add a little to that, Jason, I think one of the interesting points for us is, and these things are always obvious in hindsight, but you feel like they're big ahas at the time, is what's happening is not really surprising, is physicians are going first to patients who are highly symptomatic. So palliative care patients, radio recurrent patients, patients with large prostates have a high degree of symptomatology, and they don't have a lot of good choices, the physician there. So they go there first, they have success, and off that success, then they go into intermediate stage prostate cancer that are less symptomatic, but it's because they've gotten, it's easier to get comfortable when the cost-benefit ratio leans heavily towards the benefit, because the cost ratio of the symptomatology is so high. But for us, it's really interesting because the physicians are pulling us there,
right,
and yet it's totally obvious in hindsight.
Yes. So, Jason, just to continue on this theme, there are a couple of other things that we think are resonating. One of them is that I think that the safety profile of our product is impressive, and I think, as you can imagine, this is a, you know, cancer treatment. These are serious diseases. And so I think having a product that has a very strong safety profile helps them say, hey, I know going into a new treatment, I know this is a safer safer option for the patient. Another thing that is resonating is that this is an image-guided procedure, and so at the end of the procedure, they actually have a very good idea of how well the treatment has gone. And that predictability, that ability for them to say, I have done it well, or hey, I missed something, or so on, that gives the urologist a lot of confidence because they know what they've done. And I think that confidence will help drive adoption as well. And the final point that we are now feeling pretty comfortable that in a routine day they can do four procedures, and that in the, during that procedure it is not highly taxing. The taxing part is really inserting the tubes and then surgical planning part, and then once the planning is done, the ablation is automated, and they watch the screen, but it's not something that they're constantly having to really intensely work on. And so I think that this ease of use is also likely to resonate. So hopefully you will hear all of these things on the 11th from them directly as well. And your last question, if I can remember correctly, on market entry. So we, as you know, we do have partnerships with Philips and Siemens. So for the capital portion, we will work with them. In our press release, we will announce we have actually broadened and deepened our relationship with Siemens also a little bit more compared to our past. And we will work with them in early stage to make sure that when we, you know, I think the urology community is getting to know us, but I think the administration, having a bigger brother will help us with administration. And then for the utilization, we believe we will hire clinical people who will help drive day-to-day adoption. And at the moment, we're thinking about hiring a few people. In fact, we've just posted them on our website. We're just getting started, so we expect to have, you know, a couple of people by summer to be ready and prepared for the launch in the fall. So I hope I've answered all your questions, Jason.
Yeah, sorry about the length of all those questions. Just a couple of follow-ups. You mentioned this in your response to my question, the safety profile of TULSA. It's kind of difficult to figure out what I can ask or maybe what you can say with respect to data. But obviously, when I think of safety within a prostate cancer therapy, I think about the side effect profile that various therapies have, specifically incontinence and impotence. And so do you think, you know, I'm guessing you can't talk about those data even if you knew them. Maybe tell us if you know them, and in which case you can't talk about them. And then secondly, what sort of do you think that will be important to physicians as it relates to how they may ultimately use TULSA within these various procedures? And then lastly, and I'll get back in queue, maybe update us on plans for future trials, whether it be trials that would be designed to get you approvals for BPH or others, or if you think you need the additional trials for additional approvals, or if you'll focus more on the cost effectiveness vis-a-vis trials that would drive reimbursement for the technology, whether it be in prostate cancer or in BPH. Thank you.
Sure. So, Jason, I am, when I talk about the safety, so first of all, you're right, we are not disclosing any data from the TAC trial at the moment. We will disclose it properly at the AUA and so on. And the safety that I was referring to is the procedural-related side effects, and those were, in fact, already, those are already public information. And it's really very strong data. So the point being that the surgeons know that by using this procedure, they're not, you know, they're not imparting any significant safety risk to the patient. And yes, it trickles over to the side effects and so on, but, you know, explicitly I was referring to the data from what's already in public domain. Now, what we can tell you is that the safety profile from the commercial work that is being done in Europe is very positive, and that is positive with respect to all of the data, all of the questions related to their side effects and efficacy.
And quality of life.
And quality of life. And, I mean, particularly the patients are finding it to be a very tolerable product, very easy for them, not even needing prescription-grade analgesics is quite positive. So I think that to the extent that we can talk about commercial and the data that's already public, I think that's the reference point from our perspective.
Okay, and then the trial question?
Sure. So on the trial, Jason, we do plan to present the we have pretty good ideas now. We think we have very good plan that we have developed, and we will on the 11th sort of lay them out a little bit for you in more detail. Yes.
Interestingly, Jason, from our European experience, what we see is there's a very interesting – so you probably know in Europe they particularly like doing targeted or focal therapies, and we've had very good quality of life or side effects with those patients. And the feedback, interestingly, when you do focal or targeted therapy, you're basically erring on the side of reducing side effects and improving quality of life versus efficacy, because there's a balance between how conservative should I be in avoiding nerve bundles and other critical anatomy versus how aggressive should I be in making sure I get all of it to get all the cancer. When you do focal therapy, you're erring on the side of conservative. One of the really interesting points we hear from patients in Europe is a couple have had either recurrences or it's more accurately probably cancer occur after the therapy, let's say a year later as an example, in a place where they didn't treat because they didn't see cancer there earlier. And the patient's choices are all open. Do I want to have radiation? Do I want to have surgery? And we're hearing resoundingly those who are having a second procedure, they want another TULSA,
Right. Which
tells us a lot in the real world about the physician and the patient's happiness with the quality of life and side effects profile and the comfort with the efficacy.
Super. Thanks for all the detail. I'll get back in queue.
Thanks, Jason.
And our next question comes from Ben Hainer with Alliance Global Partners. Please go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, guys. Thanks for taking the questions.
Good afternoon, Ben.
First off, for me, you know, just thinking about the data that you'll be able to release for TACT, you know, obviously a lot of it's going to be coming at AUA, but is there, I think I recall you having the ability to announce some of the data related to the primary endpoints prior to AUA. Am I correct in my remembrance of, my remembrance of that, and can you disclose, if so, what data that we might expect to see?
So, Ben, you're right. The primary endpoint is, in fact, already public, and we met the primary endpoint resolutely in the sense that the primary endpoint was PSA, and the expectation was 75% reduction in the PSA in 75% of the patients, and we have published that it was 95% of the patients reduced PSA by 95%, and the nadir PSA was 0.36. And, you know, I think we will update that, but I think that 90-day data was pretty strong. So we feel pretty good about the primary endpoint. I think the rest of it is going to be, you know, all the side effects, and so on, and there's a lot of detail in the data. There's a lot of information. So, and we will also try to put it in context with respect to, you know, one of the things that is that we have learned, and I think you and the analyst community already know these things, is that, you know, there's published data on all of these things, and then there's what I kind of call word of mouth hearsay from a urologist. And, you know, we want to compare published data, which is, you know, FDA-registered studies with FDA-registered studies. And then we want to be able to share commercial experience to be able to compare with commercial hearsay information so that we're comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges. And so I think that over the next, you know, 60, 90 days, you will get a lot of this information. So we, even on the 11th, our thinking is we would have, you know, investigators from TACT present their experience. We will have European users who will be coming across their planning, and they will be talking about their commercial experience. And you'll be able to get pretty good indication of, you know, the appropriate comparative data and the appropriate commercial data.
Okay, great. That's definitely helpful, and for sure looking forward to the analyst/investor day. It sounds like some of the things, the events that you did at your previous company that were very helpful. And then just thinking about how the usage is tracking in Europe, you know, kind of you laid out the cases of where people are gravitating. Are there any, you know, data points in terms of specific numbers that, you know, for instance, 40% are BPH cases, you know, 27% are palliative care cases, et cetera, that you can share, or is that something we would might be able to see at the analyst day?
So, Ben, actually, in our presentation posted on our website, our investor presentation, there's a slide towards the back third that shows one of our site with the most real-world experience in Europe, their cases performed by quarter, broken down by, for instance, focal therapy, prostate, BPH, and whole gland. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but what you'll see is in like Q4, it was probably at least 50% BPH cases. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think in general, Ben, I think if you look at the breakdown, I would say 40% are BPH, which are large prostate BPH. About 40% are ablated between 50 and 90%. And then the other 20% are either whole gland or less than 50% ablations or some extreme cases. So it does look like the primary volume usage is likely to be in those targeted therapies versus disease-targeted and large volume BPH.
Got it. And that, thank you for pointing me to that chart. That's very helpful. I think the last one I had seen was Q2 data was the last one on that chart. So thank you there.
We're going to try to keep that updated. So you can see the variety of cases that are being done.
Perfect. That'll be helpful. And then lastly for me, you mentioned in, I think, the prepared remarks about the sales momentum you're seeing with Sonalive outside the U.S. You know, can you characterize, you know, maybe what the sales pipeline looks like there and, you know, how that's developing versus, you know, maybe 3 months ago, 6 months ago, what have you?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the Sonalive asset was acquired from Philips, and we spent last year really revamping the sales strategy and the marketing strategy, and we decided that the best fit for the product as it exists is, in fact, in Asia, and that uterine fibroids and some pain management are the two clear applications. And in Asia, we now have a couple of sites that are operating, just like we talk about the German site that is operating through Tulsa. There's a site in South Korea that is treating patients at the run rate of about 200 patients a year. Average patient is treated in about 2 hours. There is a very good patient selection process that they have developed, which is working very well. So bottom line, we have a very good model in place where, you know, economics has been fully developed. What's the economic model? How the patients are selected? The same thing, the patients are feeling that they are, the pain stops within 24 hours. And if they are getting the treatment in the afternoon, they may spend the night because of grogginess, because of the anesthesia, but not necessarily for the MR. They literally get up from the MR and they can go to bed someplace, so they don't need to be in a stretcher. So the based upon all this, we've actually identified a segment in Asia, a set of hospitals, and we have hired our first major, you know, first our full-time business development person there. We are, you know, continuing to work with Philips quite aggressively. Philips is quite excited to be working with us in China because the markets are growing and it gives them a differentiation. So they are kind of liking the positioning that we have developed there. So that certainly we are, you know, I think, again, we just got started in September, so I am certainly a little bit cautious about the fact that we are early, but yes, I think the strategy is working and the pipeline gives us more confidence for 2019.
Excellent. Thank you so much for the color, and I guess I'll see you in about a month.
Yes, perfect, perfect.
Our next question comes from Brian Gagnon with Gagnon Securities. Please go ahead, sir.
Hello, gentlemen. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, Brian. Good afternoon.
So really, just two questions for you. At four times per day, how does that compare to docs doing radical prostatectomies? And the second question, I'd like for you to be able to give some detail on, if you can. In your preparation for launch, what U.S. centers are already interested and how do you plan on getting to market here, i.e., are you going to have training centers, et cetera, and have you picked any of those yet?
Surely. I'm sorry, Brian, what was the first question again? I'm sorry. I missed it.
At four procedures a day. How does that compare to docs doing radical prostatectomies?
Right.
I.e. with the robot. So,
got it. So we're actually getting quite a bit of feedback on this. So most urologists will do two robotic cases in a day. So this is effectively easily doubling the throughput. The second point is that when a robotic procedure is done, it is, they're constantly in the screen and they're moving their, using their fingers to continue to drive the robot. Versus with our procedure, even within that 2 hour period, their main effort is really insertion of the tubes in the patient. Then the anesthesia takes over and does their thing. And then they are doing planning, on the computer console. Once the planning is done, then our computer takes over and the ablation part is automated and they're watching the screen for any abnormal activity or if they feel like they need to change the boundaries or the surgical plan, they can do some of those. But overall, the point being that not only that it's about half the time, but it's also very comfortable in the way it works. So I think that is certainly one of the things we think is going to be a driver of adoption of our technology.
So doc has less physical work to do, and he can make twice the amount of money?
That's the expectation, absolutely.
Okay. And U.S. launch, what are you hearing from leading academic centers, training, et cetera?
Yes. So I can provide a little bit of color on that. We are, for example, doing our first usability testing. We're in fact doing it in Toronto. We have an amazing group, a pretty strong response to getting trained here. We're doing it in about 2 weeks. And our initial, visits with the leading hospitals, I think certainly the feedback is quite positive. I think that there is an interest. I think it's too early to provide names of the hospitals, but I think it's fair to assume that leading U.S. hospitals are interested in acquiring the technology, and I think that is part of our strategy, is we want to have teaching hospitals get going on it. We also think that there will be private clinics that cater to patient pay models that are also interested, so we will use the same, dichotomous strategy to work with the teaching hospitals, they will become education centers, and then we will also have private clinics who will hopefully be the initial volume drivers as the teaching hospitals, start to drive education, across the community.
Brian, don't take this as guidance, please.
Yeah.
But, our goal is to have really high utilization, happy customers. Our experience is we have a group who, after 18 months, is at a run rate of 100 patients, who thinks they can get to potentially 200 patients a year by the end of this year. When you can get sites doing 200 procedures a year and we're making $3,500 revenue per disposable, so we're looking at like $700,000 per site, our goal is within the first quarter or two, let's get five sites started who we think are either really important teaching sites or really high volume. Let's make sure they're super happy, super successful, and then get the next 10, and then they get to the next 25. But really do the blocking and tackling and making sure we have really happy customers who are high utilization sites so we can really support them well, ensure that, that their success breeds success. We think, we should be very measured and go out there to really have high utilization sites that are very, very happy customers.
Terrific. Thank you all. Look forward to seeing you on the 11th.
Thank you so much, Brian.
And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. And our next question comes from Andre Uden with Mackey Research Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, Andre. Good afternoon.
Toby Ma on behalf of Andre Uden. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I have a couple of questions here. So first, can you please provide any updates on your discussions with the FDA for Sonalive in the U.S. and maybe a potential regulatory timeline?
That's a great question. We have communicated with the FDA. We have a very good strategy in place, and I am sorry, but we do plan to discuss it in detail on the 11th of April. So we will hopefully present that detail to you. For today, I think we can tell you that we have received positive feedback from the FDA, and we are in a process.
Okay, thank you. And my second question is also for the TULSA-PRO for the U.S. market. So what would be a reasonable estimate for incremental SG&A for the first year of launch from a modeling viewpoint?
We don't provide guidance, so we can't give you we're not in a position to give you specifics. But, again, follow the model that I just referenced where start off with five really important sites, with success the next 10, with success the next 25. That's not a highly capital-intensive approach to the market. That is a high capital efficiency model. We have reason to believe that it's the capital efficiency of that is such that if you have five high-performing sites, the people should effectively be paying for themselves within a few quarters. And so it shouldn't churn through a lot of capital.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I will stop here.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And there appear to be no further questions at this time, so I will turn the call back over to Arun Menawat for closing comments.
Thank you, and I would like to again invite everyone to please join us on the 11th of April. You will have a number of surgeons and radiologists presenting how they're using our product, both from the U.S. and from Europe. Hopefully that was a pretty good idea of the potential adoption of our technology. With that, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Talk to you soon.